Begin whenever you. We're ready to begin the recording whenever you're
Don
ready.
Don McElwain joins.
Okay, we've started the recording. So, welcome everyone. This is the meeting of the Intellectual Property Constituency. I'd like to introduce myself. My name is J. Scott Evans. I am president of the Intellectual Property Constituency. I'm senior legal director at Yahoo for Global Brands and Trademarks. I'm also a member of the International Trademark Association Board of Directors and a member of its Executive Committee. I would also like to introduce Steve Metallitz. Steve?
Steve Metallitz. I'm representing the Coalition for Online Accountability, which is an IPC member, and I'm incoming vice president of the IPC.
So at the beginning of the meeting, I would like to say that for those in the room, we have a sign-up sheet that is starting to go around. If you would put the information, your name and your organization on there for us so that we can have that for our minutes. Nick Wood from Validaeus and Cum Laude has graciously agreed, as he oft does, to take our minutes. And Stacy, that means you're off the hook if you've made it on the phone. I will have to say I apologize. Several of our officers and members could not make it because, for some reason, we all met in Phoenix, and about half of them walked away with bronchitis and pneumonia and are at home suffering from various ailments. So to Fabrizio and Stacy, we wish you good health, and we hope that you're back to par soon. With that, I would like to start our agenda off. We're going to have a presentation from ICANN's compliance staff. And we have Stacy Burnett here with us today and Pam Little. They presented to us many times in the past, and we always appreciate them giving time from what is, I am sure, the most hectic of schedules to come with us and let us know the processes that they are going through, the progresses that they are making. And so I'm going to turn it over to you, Stacy.
Thank you, Jay Scott. I wanted to share with you, I believe I met with this group before and introduced Pam to most of you, but I wanted to share with you again. She's been super instrumental in assisting us in resolving complex compliance issues in the Asia-Pacific region, which she's responsible for. And so she's been a huge and valuable addition to our staff. And if you haven't met her before, I hope you'll get a chance during the week to chat with Pam. So without further delay, I will start my presentation. We have an agenda today. I'm going to go over our enforcement summary, a summary of the compliance notices we've sent recently. I'm going to share with you information about ongoing audits, some of the enhancements made to the Who Is Data Problem Report system. Steve and I had a meeting earlier this year, and he requested an update on some of the enhancements that we've made to the Who Is Data Problem Report system. And I'm going to give you an update regarding some of the staffing efforts we're making to fill open positions. So I will start. This is a summary of the terminated and non-renewed registrars over the past several years. And there has been some chatter that ICANN only enforces only enforces fee payment provisions in the RAA, and that's simply not true. If you'll go to our website and look at the past 22 compliance notices that were issued this year, you will find that most of them list other issues in addition to money, such as failure to provide WHOIS access, failure to update primary contact information, failure to escrow registration data, and other issues. So we are enforcing the contract, not just the non-payment of fee provisions. And at any time, I don't know if we want to do questions afterwards or during.
I think it'd be best if we waited to the end of your presentation.
Sure. Okay, so I'll proceed. We recently started maintaining statistics on how many compliance notices we send. And in order for you to understand what this means, I need to share with you a little bit about our compliance process. When we suspect noncompliance or we make a determination there's been noncompliance, it's our initial attempt to resolve those issues informally. So we'll send a compliance notice, or we'll get on the phone and contact a registrar to let them know there's a problem. And between the period of August to November 2010, we sent 1,588 compliance notices, and those are the different problems that we were citing in these different compliance notices. And what we're finding is, based on our record this year and last year, registrars believe we're serious about escalating compliance matters. And so when we send these compliance notices, they respond, they act. And we are aggressively sending these notices of noncompliance to the 960-plus ICANN-accredited registrars. Some of our ongoing audits. One audit concerns the inter-registrar transfer policy, and we decided to audit in this area because we receive a significant percentage of our complaints concerning transfers. And so to determine if there's something that should be done in terms of policy to address issues, we believe this audit might enlighten those who are in the policy development process concerning some changes to the transfer policy. Also, we want to assist registrars in better understanding their obligations under the inter-registrar transfer policy, and just we want to improve overall compliance. So we recently conducted this audit, and I'm going to let Pam explain a little bit about the methodology of the audit because she was responsible for it.
Okay. Hi. Just very quickly. We set up a plan in consultation with the registrar, a number of key registrar's representatives. And this was a long time in the making. We started this process about November last year, consulting them how to go about transfer audit because, as just everyone in this room would know, there are a large number of domains get transferred every day, every month, every year. So we had to have some sort of random mechanism to look at registrar's behavior, practices, processes. So they gave a lot of good advice how to go about it, and we drew up this plan. We tested this audit plan in May this year, and we also then ran an audit, like a beta audit, based on this plan, just to test whether the plan was sound and operationally, you know, from a resource perspective, all sound. We did that in May, and we published the results of that beta audit in our contractual compliance newsletter in October. If you haven't seen it, please go to the compliance website or pages to look at this report. You might be interested in the findings. What I want to stress here is, overall, the policy seems to be working. Most of transfers get transferred without problems, but we do get, you know, as Stacey already stated, a large percentage of complaints we get from consumers involving transfer issues. That's why we thought we want to understand the problems better and also to educate registrars as well as educate registrars about the policy and try to improve the compliance rate among registrars. So that was the purpose of the audit. And we also did a recent audit in a formal audit after the beta audit. Started in September. We finalized the audit. We're in the process of finalizing the audit report, which we hope will be published very shortly. We had some issues and concerns from the registrar stakeholder group. We had a very constructive meeting with that group about how to try to resolve those issues. So I would also, again, encourage you to look out for the report, the audit results, which should come out shortly.
Thank you, Pam. Another audit that we have ongoing concerns port 43 and access to WHOIS information. We developed a software tool that monitors registrars' port 43 services, and it checks their port 43 services every hour. And we determined this was important because, of course, WHOIS data is important, but if you can't access the data, then you don't even know if it's accurate or not. And we've had complaints from the community that certain registrars' port 43 tools don't work regularly. And so we developed this tool, and we've been using it for about the past 6 weeks. And since we've been using it, we've sent 6 compliance inquiries based on our first round of monitoring, and we issued 2 notices of breach based on failure to provide, to consistently provide port 43 WHOIS access. And so we're in the beta test process, and we are continuing to update this tool so that it will be robust, and we'll continue monitoring registrars' port 43 services and enforcing compliance in that area. As you all know, the WHOIS data problem report system is used by the public to report WHOIS inaccuracy claims. And over the years, we've made enhancements, and we realize future enhancements will probably be made, but I wanted to share with you the latest set of enhancements to this system. Right now, when someone files a WHOIS inaccuracy claim and it concerns a domain name that was suspended, deleted, or expired, the person filing the claim never receives information that the report has been rejected because the domain name is expired, deleted, or suspended. And so we ask our IT folks to send a message to the person filing the complaint that their complaint has been deemed invalid, and this is the reason why. Another change to the system, which we think is a very important change, and I think we've consulted with this constituency before to develop this process that we have now through this enhancement, after the 15 days after a person files a WHOIS inaccuracy claim, the registrar will receive a message from ICANN, and the message will allow them to make one of 4 choices to show what action they took in response to the claim. One of the selections they can make is the registrar verified the contact info as correct. Another selection will be the domain name was suspended, deleted, or expired. Another option they can choose is the contact information was updated, or they can request additional time, and we're talking about allowing them another 15 days. And so by filling out one of these or checking one of these options, it allows ICANN to know exactly what happened within 15 days. We'll be able to report to the person who filed the complaint what happened concerning their domain name, and it allows us to keep better statistics concerning the usefulness of this entire system. And we are still beta testing some of these, but it's our goal to have them operational by the end of this year. So what is today, the 5th? So 7th. All the days are running together for me. We believe this is a good change. The community will get instant or semi-instant feedback about their WHOIS inaccuracy claim that they filed. Another change will be a 45-day compliance notice will go to the registrar. I think earlier in my presentation, I briefly explained the compliance process and how we routinely give the registrar informal notice that there was a compliance issue. And by sending this automatic notice of noncompliance, we've given them that notice. And so if they decide to ignore the notice or not act on it, then we're in a position to send a notice of breach because we followed our process and gave them the informal notice that we always give. So I think this is a good position for us to act quickly on notices of breach concerning WHOIS inaccuracy or failure to investigate WHOIS inaccuracy claims. Several of you, I'm sure, have had questions and expressed concern about open positions within the compliance department. And we are actively identifying candidates and interviewing candidates to fill the 3 open positions. And it's our aim to have those positions filled by the first, by early 2011. I don't want to commit to the first 20 days because you guys will send us a notice after the 21st day. Using the system. So by early 2011, we hope to have these positions filled and introduce you to the new staff members as soon as they come on board. So we are available to answer your questions if you have any, and I'm sure you do.
So we will take a cue. Yes, Andy? And if you would please announce yourself for the record so those on the phone know who you are.
Andy Coombs from IACC. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Andy.
You noted that there were about 1,600 compliance notices over the past 3 years for a universe of around, did I get that wrong?
It wasn't the past 3 years. It was the past 3 or 4 months.
4 months.
4 months, excuse me. 1,600 compliance notices to a universe of about 1,000 or fewer registrars.
That's correct.
That suggests that the distribution is somewhat uneven, that there are some registrars getting multiple notices. And I think it might be helpful to understand the steps between the initial compliance notice and termination, because obviously there's some form of escalation that has to occur if in fact there is that kind of uneven distribution.
Okay, so what happens is sometimes we receive complaints from the community, or you might send me an email, like you've done in the past, complaining about a particular registrar's action or inaction. And our first, depending on how strong the claim is and the evidence that has been presented, we might send a notice saying you're not complying in a particular area. Please correct within a certain period of time. There are often complaints that are received where it doesn't give us sufficient evidence to make a claim to the registrar there's noncompliance. So it's sort of an inquiry. We've received this complaint. Can you give us more information about this matter so that we can make a determination whether there's been compliance or noncompliance? And so after we send this, what we call an informal notice of suspected noncompliance or actual noncompliance, and we give them a date to correct, sometimes there are conversations that are held in between that time because it could be a complex matter. It could be a simple matter. Maybe they'll get back to us and claim they've corrected, but they haven't fully corrected. So every situation is not the same. It really depends on the facts and circumstances, how quickly a noncompliance issue can and will be resolved. But let's say this is a relatively easy issue to resolve. Let's assume the registrar ignores our notice. We might send a second or third notice or get on the phone. If that's ignored, then our next option is either we can consider suspension or there are these other tools in the new RAA, but if the registrar is operating under the old RAA, then we might consider termination. If they've ignored, I'm sorry, a notice of breach. Notice of breach is the first step that we take, which is like escalated compliance, and that notice is published on our website. And if the registrar fails to correct within 15 days as required by the RAA, then we might consider termination. So I don't know if that answered the question. Hopefully it did. Did it, Andy?
Somewhat. I guess as a kind of follow-up, I think we all are familiar sort of some registrars being more problematic than others. And I guess what I want to try and understand is whether there's a differential escalation. If you get one complaint about a huge registrar, that's different from 10 or 15 complaints about a small registrar. And do you treat each complaint separately so they escalate largely on the same kind of process you describe? Or if you've got like 15 complaints in a 3-month period that you've had to act on with respect to one registrar, are you quicker to escalate that sort of situation to a notice of breach?
It really depends on the facts and circumstances. If we've received 15 complaints about a registrar and it's all in the same area, concerning the same matter, we might have a telephone conversation with them. What's going on here? We've gotten 15 complaints. You said you corrected. 2 days later, we're getting the same complaint. It's not our goal to terminate registrars, like how many can we terminate this year? That's not the goal. The goal is to bring registrars into compliance. And so we have several conversations when it looks like there's a pattern. But if they're not responding to our requests for correction or they're ignoring our calls, that's when we have to escalate it more. So it really depends. I know Pam has had some experiences with some of our Asian registrars where she's had several conversations about the same matter. Did you want to share some of that?
Sure. I think, Andy, to answer your questions, I think we try to treat registrars consistently, and all RA actually requires ICANN to act in an open and transparent manner when dealing with registrars. And we do try to do that, but as you know, and many people in this room are lawyers, you know, sometimes treat them consistently might not be the best approach. So we try to treat them equitably. Let's say if we know there's a willful breach, we know this registrar has set out to do these bad things or whatever, then our approach would be different to, say, a registrar in a developing country. Maybe we just have one case. I was told 6 registrars in South America. One of them didn't have the WHOIS server up and running. And we spend our staff who speaks Portuguese or actually help compliance staff get on the phone, spend an hour and a half talking to this registrar, trying to help them to become compliant. So it varies. You know, it's not saying we have differential treatment, but sometimes to have a just outcome, it actually demands different treatments.
All right. Are there any other questions?
Just got a question.
Yeah, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is it working? Yeah, okay, thank you. I had 2 questions about the WDPRS and the improvements. First, there are a number of days duration in there. So after 15 days, I'm not sure if I got this right, but the registrar is supposed to respond within 15 days, and it can ask for an additional 15 days one time, right? And then you automatically send a compliance notice if you haven't heard any response in 45 days. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Where did those numbers come from? Is that in the contract, or is that your determination that that's the appropriate amount of time to give the registrar to respond?
So the 15-day period for them to report or to take action, that's in the contract.
Okay. And then the decision to allow them to have 15 more days, that's the compliance.
That's not in the contract, but we do realize there are certain times when the registrar may be having trouble contacting the registrant about a correction
and about
a change or verification.
Okay. All right, and so your view is that the third party, the public, bears the risk of that rather than the registrant bearing the risk of that if the WHOIS data is inaccurate. So you've made that decision to give them another 15 days. And then the 45-day limit, where does that come from? Because as I understand it, if after 15 days there's no response, let's say you just don't hear anything, then it sits in suspension kind of for 30 days, and then on the 45th day, the compliance notice is sent. Is that the usual? Have I got that right? I may have misunderstood that.
That's how it's being proposed.
Okay.
One of the good things about sharing these proposed processes with the public and with different constituencies is we can take back better suggestions. And that's why when you asked me to come here and share the enhancements with the group, I was happy to, because if you believe we need to reconsider some things, we will.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And I understand, too, that, you know, if 15 days is in the contract, you have no option about that. That's a given. But I would encourage you to think about whether adding an additional 30 days onto that
before the compliance notice comes out
is really the right period. Because, again, in theory, a complaint has come in, a false WHOIS data, and nothing has been done about it. So, the registrar is bound by a contract that says they'll do something within 15 days. So I'm just questioning whether giving them 3 times that long before you actually issue a compliance notice is maybe a little excessively generous to them. The other question I had is I've often had the experience where I filed a WDPRS complaint and the WHOIS data is changed, but it's still inaccurate. At first the first registration said it was Barack Obama at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and then it's changed to David Cameron at 10 Downing Street. So how does the system accommodate? I suspect that's not unusual, that if someone is pinged for false WHOIS data, they provide new false WHOIS data if they don't really want to be found. How does the system accommodate that, or how would the proposed system accommodate that?
I don't know that the system – I don't think the system necessarily accommodates that. The person would more than likely have to file another WHOIS inaccuracy claim. And as you know, the contract doesn't require registrars to provide accurate WHOIS information. The contract requires registrars to conduct an investigation. So I can see a registrar coming back to ICANN saying, I conducted an investigation. The registrant gave me new information. I put that new information in the WHOIS. I can't verify who this person is necessarily every time they come back with a new set of WHOIS data. So I think there are some gaps in the policy. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. There are gaps in the policy. I wonder whether you have flexibility within the policy, though, to – I think – that the registrar is required to make some reasonable investigation. I may have that adjective wrong.
No, you actually I would agree with you on this one, that the registrar is required to conduct an investigation upon notice that there's a WHOIS inaccuracy. And so the first time a member of the public files a complaint concerning a WHOIS inaccuracy, the registrar is required to conduct this investigation. Once they conduct the investigation, maybe the registrant provides new data. It's my understanding the registrar is not required to investigate whether that new information is valid until they receive another WHOIS inaccuracy claim.
Okay, so the whack-a-mole is built into the system from your perspective. A registrar is fully within the contract if it accepts blatantly false WHOIS correction data.
I don't see how you can read the contract any other way when the contract requires the registrar to conduct an investigation upon receiving information of a WHOIS inaccuracy. So if someone provides false information after a registrar requested an update because the old information was invalid, that registrar is not obligated to do anything other than input the new information until a new WHOIS inaccuracy claim is filed.
Okay. I appreciate your response because you guys know this contract inside out. I mean, you've been living with
it. But you know it too.
And breathing it. So, I think, we talked earlier today about the work to try to improve the registrar accreditation agreement. And in my view, this is one area where it definitely needs to be improved. And that is one of the items on the high priority list that was produced by the drafting team that was looking at this. But I really appreciate your bringing all of this to us and explaining it. I think it is going to help improve the system, and I thank you also for your answers about the contract.
Thanks, Steve. Claudio DeGangi.
Yes, Claudio DeGangi on staff with INTA. Hi, Stacey and Pam.
Hi.
Hi. I just had two questions. With the data reporting system, how generally do members of the public know about that system? Is it in a clear spot on the ICANN website, or how are people basically supposed to know about it and submit requests?
It's not as if we do any advertising about it, so I don't know how members of the public necessarily find out about it, but people do find out about it because we do receive thousands of WHOIS inaccuracy claims every year. So, again, I am not aware of any marketing that's going on to let the public know. I know this constituency is aware of it. Other intellectual property attorneys around the world are aware of it. So maybe it's word of mouth. Maybe it's through participation in different organizations. I don't know.
Is that something you guys might consider putting up on the website somewhere?
I mean, it is on our website. If you type in WHOIS inaccuracy, I'm certain you can get to it somehow.
So you have to search for it, though, on the site.
Probably. But is your suggestion, maybe I should ask this question directly, is your suggestion that we put a prominent icon somewhere on the homepage?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep,
we'll take that back.
All right. And the second question is, the GNSO right now is looking at the RAA and considering possible changes to that, which might include some new compliance requirements for registrars. And it'll lead to a negotiation between staff and the registrars. Is that something that the compliance department is going to be involved in, you know, up front in the process, so you could provide your input into that process?
Now, I don't think we'll be involved in the negotiations. We did provide input in terms of the new RAA proposals, and that will probably be the extent of our participation. We're the enforcers of the contract. We're not parties to the contract. I mean, I can as a whole as a party, but I don't believe we'll be involved in the negotiations.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Claudio. Do we have anyone from the chat room that's asking any questions? No? Paul, do you have a question? Paul McGrady?
J. Scott Adam Scoville for the queue.
Is that Adam Scoville? Who was that on the phone?
That was Adam Scoville.
Okay. Paul,
sorry,
and then
the audio is cutting in and out a bit, depending upon the mics in the room. Sorry.
Okay. Adam, Paul has conceded the floor to you.
Just a quick question. Stacey, hi. This is Adam Scoville from RE/MAX. You mentioned enforcement actions and that sort of trying to sort of dispel the myth that enforcement actions only happen when there's a fee dispute, and you mentioned that there was a bunch of enforcement actions that also mentioned other sort of problems, be they failure to provide WHOIS information and so forth. Are there I'm only, if I recall correctly, I've only seen a notice of I think one, and I'm just curious the extent of how many there are or how common there is, where there are notices that do not involve fee disputes and are just for these sort of other issues, and I guess I might also exclude in that the you know, sort of catastrophic failures like the register fly circumstance. You know, is you know, because the fact that some other things might be mentioned doesn't necessarily seem to answer the question whether most of the time in practice it takes a fee dispute before a registrar looks potentially at getting towards the upper escalations of what might happen to it.
Okay, so there are compliance notices on our website that do not mention fees at all. Let me share this with you. Often when a registrar is, and it's not as if we look at the money first. Sometimes we find another issue and then we'll say, check the money files, and lo and behold, they're delinquent. And so often money is an indicator for some registrars that other problems are on the horizon because they're failing to pay their fees. They may be failing to provide other services that require money for them to continue operating. And then when there are complex registrar issues, fees are a quick way to proceed with terminating the registrar when they've been behind in their fees. And we've already sent them a notice of breach for that. It allows us to move forward quickly on termination. So it's not as if we're only looking for fees. Again, there are some notices on our page. The recent ones I just told you about for failure to provide Port 43 service, they don't even mention fees. It's just failure to provide Port 43 service as required by the contract. And so in response to the question, often when some registrar has another problem, we'll also check the fee records, and they may have two issues, the other issue and fees, and so we proceed with both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And this will be the last question on this topic, and then we're going to move forward in the agenda. And for our technical people, we've been advised that the online audio is not functioning.
Morning. This is more of a comment than a question. In the last several months, as we all know, the compliance department's been even more understaffed and under lots of pressure to accomplish a lot of things. And the one thing I really would like to praise you, your team, for is the sense of ownership. Oftentimes when people get busy, they become cranky, they become less professional, and they start to hit things back over the tennis net at people rather than dealing with them. And I found that even though you guys are under immense pressure and are short-staffed, you're not doing that. You are taking ownership of things. You are chasing things down. You are seeing things through. And I greatly appreciate that ownership that you take in the problems that we send you.
Thank you. And can we give you a kiss afterwards?
That's the only reason he did it. He just wanted kisses. Have you met him? All right. Look at him. He'd have to do anything he can. Next, we're going to go right. We leave off with kisses. We go into .xxs. We're just accelerating right into a lot of stuff here. So as many of you know, .xxx has come forward with a proposal with regards to intellectual property rights mechanisms that is, in this space, unique. And for that reason, we have asked two of the individuals to come forward today and to present to this group the RPMs that they're suggesting in their rollout. So, Nick, I'd like you to come up, and I'll take notes while you moderate.
I think Jonathan's just going to do it. It's fine. So you say.
All right. Have a seat.
Now, which is the...
You're on that computer there. Steve is trying to be a technician. It's not going well.
That's not clear.
We're just trying to get, for those on the phone, we're trying to get the PowerPoint to work. And I think, we're getting pretty bamboo. Okay, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, row, row. How many IP attorneys does it take to start a PowerPoint? Sure. While we're in this break, those of you on the phone, if you would please announce yourself for the scribe so that he can get you into the minutes. We know that we have Adam Scoville there because he's already spoken. Others?
Sam.
I heard Stacy King and Sam.
Doug Eisenberg.
I think it was Don Eisenberg. Is that it?
Fabricio noted that he's on the forum, but he's not dialed in.
Who's that?
Also, Ann Scalise.
Okay, Ann and Scalise.
Ellen Shankman's also on Adobe, but hasn't dialed in.
All right, we're up and running. We're cooking with gas. So here we go. Take it away.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, all of you, for giving us the opportunity to come and talk with you. There's a sense that people would like to know what's likely to happen in the proposed launch of XXX, and so this is an opportunity to give you a heads up as to the likely approach to rights protection in the new TLD. Validaeus has recently contracted with XXX in order to provide the services of validation and implement the agreed policy for rights protection under the new TLD. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Jonathan Robinson. I've worked for many years in the corporate domain name management sector with NetNames, and so that's my background related to this particular area. I'm going to be working with Validaeus as the program director on this particular piece of work, and it's a great opportunity to introduce, implement, and execute, as Jay Scott said, some innovative new ways of dealing with this particular issue that troubles many IP owners. Just to let you know, I have a set of one sheet takeaways. So, and that covers more than the content in the presentation, or at least as much as is in the presentation. So, there's no need to take notes of anything on the slides. If I'll hand the takeaways out at the end, and of course provide electronic copies if anyone would like those. So, very briefly, I'll take you through the approach, the mechanism, the timing, the kind of fee structure, and this is an opportunity because we're to take your feedback as well and get feedback from you either in this forum or in the near future. So, of course, we'd welcome that because there's substantial accumulated expertise both in rights protection in general and as they apply to TLDs. So as we've said, this is part of a comprehensive and innovative approach to rights protection, and in particular the unique and specific aspect that's being dealt with in the XXX TLD is the opportunity for rights owners to reserve and block names from use in the TLD. So there is a deliberate and specific move away from the traditional method of defensive registrations and all that entails, both in terms of the cost of the initial registration, the maintenance, and so on. There is a recognition and an acceptance that many rights owners will simply not want to participate in the TLD in the conventional sense and would like to secure one or more terms for such that they are not active domain names in the TLD. So it offers effective protection of intellectual property within the TLD to businesses operating outside of the adult entertainment industry, but also at the same time recognizes that XXX is a sponsored community TLD and has particular requirements in that respect, and of course responds to early feedback. Apologies. So the critical point about the structure is that there are going to be three routes into the registry through the sunrise period, but in particular for this audience, the primary routes of concern are sunrise A and B, as they are really related to prior rights and the opportunity to deal with either trademarks within the adult entertainment industry or those without. So looking in a little more detail then, the first route into the registry is Sunrise A, and that's available to existing rights owners who operate within the adult entertainment industry, and ultimately the result of going down that route would be an active, usable registration within the registry. The requirement here is to produce both a relevant trademark and also be a member of the community. The fact that this is a sponsored community TLD means in the event of an overlap in an exact match between Sunrise A and another one of the routes, Sunrise B, or otherwise means this is very likely to prevail. This is the priority route, and in any event, any term taken down through this route will be validated. Similarly with Sunrise B, and in many ways this is the essence of what's important, I believe, to this particular audience and related areas, is that this is for existing rights owners with rights outside of the adult entertainment industry, and the critical point being here, this will result in a non-resolving name or a blocking term at the registry. It to the extent that it does resolve, it will resolve to a standard form of white page, simply indicating that the string is reserved from use in the registry and not attributing it to any particular commercial entity or blocker of that name. And the corresponding who is information is likely to be similarly bland and at most contain standard registry contact details. And in particular, as you might expect, any mark or right taken down through this route will be subject to validation. Sunrise C is probably of or Route C is really probably a better way of describing it. I should say, actually, these are intended to be memorable by virtue of the fact that Sunrise A applies to the adult industry, Sunrise B blocked, in case that didn't stand out already, and Sunrise C is available for members of the adult entertainment industry and subscribers to the community that can demonstrate that they have an exact match in an existing TLD. This is a much lighter touch validation here. We expect to take it through an automated validation process, and this will result in the registration of a conventional resolving domain at the registry. But as I say, I don't expect that this is of particular and strong interest to this. My anticipation from you is that the blocking route is the one of most interest in this particular community. So the mechanism that's likely to be in place to implement and execute this is an online application process, which will be, I would expect, undertaken by ICANN-accredited registrars, those with whom you typically deal with as an intellectual property owner, an owner of an existing portfolio of domain names. The program itself, as I said, will be managed and executed by Validaeus under my direction, and there will be an opportunity to make either solo applications on a one-off basis via a web interface or batch applications for owners of larger, or for representatives, I guess, of multiple different businesses and therefore diverse trademarks. Clearly, this is dependent on ICM signing a contract with ICANN, which is still that event is still pending, as we all know. But we felt that it would be very useful to give you a heads up in any event as to the thinking, the direction, and create the opportunity for some feedback should there be any, whether that's positive, negative, or simply practical. There will be a short interval post-contract signing before we go through the Sunrise period. That's likely to be in the region of 90 days, followed by a 30 to 60-day Sunrise period, and then some interval for resolving any clashes or overlaps that have come through the different routes. And ultimately, this is the start, really, of a communication and outreach period, which we expect to run right through that period, running into first and second quarter of next year. The fees are likely to be as follows. There will be a one-time fee to cover submission, processing, and validation, which will, of course, be significantly reduced for C, since that's a very simple electronic validation. And to the extent that the route taken results in an active registration, there will be a requirement to pay the registry fees for the number of periods that the domain name is then registered for. Clearly, that doesn't apply in the case of Sunrise B, because Sunrise B provides for indefinite, and I think this is another key innovation, indefinite reservation or blocking of the term, and ICM does not envisage charging any additional fees, any recurring fees for the blocking of this term. It is a one-off validation exercise to create a blocked term in the registry that is then protected from further use. I should say at this point that the opportunity to convert a blocked term into a live domain name is likely to be very difficult to achieve. It is intended that these names stay out of active use. One can envisage that there may be some very specific and special circumstances where a name could come from the blocked area into live use, but that is very unlikely. It's unlikely to be a common instance, and in any event, it's hard to imagine how that might be the same entity that would be able to achieve that, because that's probably enough said on that. In other words, a name that came out of being blocked is likely to be made available more generally because it was simply not needed to be blocked anymore, rather than it being an opportunity to game the system to block names out of legitimate use. So really there is detailed policy to follow on all of this in order to bring out all of the fine detail. and to explain and communicate more widely the processes involved and, of course, the practicalities of implementation. And like I've said throughout the presentation, I and we would welcome any feedback on this. We've taken the opportunity to try and do something innovative, cost-effective, and interesting, but, of course, you may have some views on that. So thank you very much again for the opportunity to talk to you all, and welcome any comments or feedback now or in the future. And please, I'll make sure that there's the takeaways available.
I am going to take Chair's prerogative and ask the first question. I noticed that you said that the blocking registration would be blocked as long as .XXX was run by ICM. And I would suggest that you have the contract state that for blocking registrations that will apply to any successors, assigns, or anything, because what you don't want to have happen is some change in management or control at ICM happen and they want to open up and begin charging and say that that contract no longer applies, and then you run into all the problems again. And so it would just make everyone buy into it much better if they felt like it truly was. And that is not a contractual provision, at least under U.S. law, that is aberrant. It is often put in place for assurances you're trying to give partners. With that, I will open the floor to the gentleman standing at the microphone. If you would introduce yourself so the people on the phone would know who you are.
Yes, Jeffrey Douglas of the Free Speech Coalition. Sorry, Jeffrey Douglas of the Free Speech Coalition. Wanted to ask a question that arose in real life. An adult actress had the domain name Nina.com. Nina Shoes filed a WIPO complaint and claimed that the existence of an adult-associated website, even though Nina and Nina Hartley were trademarked by the actress, damaged them. Ultimately, Nina Hartley resolved it and prevailed at WIPO and ultimately resolved it civilly with Nina Shoes. But presented with that kind of conflict, can you walk through how that process might work under, I assume that would be B?
Well, it's interesting. The conflict that you've described there is a post-registration event in the .com space. But I guess what if I understand you correctly, what you're talking about there is a trademark coming down. Sunrise B.
Let's say, and if there's a Nina Shoes representative here, I do apologize.
No, it's useful to stick to the practical and real example, yeah. So it's helpful.
So let's say Nina Shoes asks the registry to block the issuance of Nina.XXX to anyone because of its association with Nina Shoes, and yet there is a trademark holder associated with the adult industry of Nina. And the timing of this, I presume, would be critical. That is, if this occurs in the rollout period, I don't even know how the possessor of Nina, the adult trademark of Nina, would know of the potential block. And so the block presumably would be in place before they had the opportunity. Or let's assume that the trademark holder of Nina applied for in timely fashion, a .XXX contemporaneous with the request from Nina Shoes to block it.
Okay.
I have no idea how the
way we envisage it, first of all, is that it's an exact match. It's not, so the trademark would have to be an exact match to qualify for the word mark would need to be an exact match to go through that. In the event that in this instance, let's just say it wasn't Nina Shoes, it was Nina that sold shoes, and all else being equal, Nina would prevail under A in this instance. But it's not simply the trademark; it is also a requirement to be a member of the community and subscribe to the rules of the community.
So if an adult entity was using a name and wished to comply with the I-4 guidelines, their historic use of the name would prevail over a trademark holder that had an identical name. Is that correct?
Presuming they both had trademarks and had trademarks registered in one of the recognized jurisdictions prior to a specific date, and so which would be the detail of the policy. But
right.
It's clearly not going to be it's clearly not going to be. There is no opportunity to register that trademark beyond today, and in fact, it will be the exact date will be backdated sometime prior to this.
Okay, so the adult usage would prevail over the non-adult usage.
Yes.
And I'd like to ask a non-trademark assumption question. I don't see a lot of other people, so if you don't mind me using the time. Assume one of two scenarios. One, that there is an adult business that currently holds, say, breasts.com. Would they be able to, if they did not wish to purchase a .xxx domain, would they be at risk of and I'm assuming that the word breasts under all circumstances is not trademarkable, would they be at risk of another entity acquiring breasts.xxx, and do they have any way to protect themselves other than to defensively acquire?
I think the answer is yes, another entity could register it, and no, they probably don't have any other way other than defensively acquiring.
Because assuming that breasts.com were itself a trademark, that is presumably different than breasts.xxx, correct? That is,
It's not. We're going to need to cut off, but I think he said it has to be an identical match to the registered mark. So if it's not an identical match, now I'm going to have to. We've got other people lined up. I appreciate your time very much. I just need to keep it moving forward. So we've got two more, Claudio and this gentleman here in the blue shirt. So we'll let the Mr. Blue Shirt go first because I saw his hand go up.
Lucas Ball from Bryce Consulting. We're intellectual. Lucas Ball from Bryce Consulting. We're an intellectual property consulting firm. Thank you for your presentation. In the case of the BKS, the blocking, will you allow wild cards like our registered trademark and, well, strings before or after the string will be allowed to block that part?
Like Nike shoes.
Like Nike shoes and Nike whatever where you won't come out with .xxx.
It's a good point. I mean, we at this stage we had envisaged exact matches, but I see that's something that's it's the extension to.
Because I'm thinking of, people are very imaginative.
I understand that, and that's exactly why we wanted to put this in front of you to test that kind of variant. So. The intention of the presentation and the communication of this is to clarify the broad concepts and the innovations, but that's a very good point.
Idea I was thinking is in the case of B application, I don't know if you actually do have yet decided the cost, which is actually will you be able to block permanently, and to see if the cost very affordable. A trademark owner could actually file for 1,000 combinations or something like that. But I think it will be much better if it will be some kind of wildcard option. I don't know if you have to think about it.
Yeah, understood, and thank you. It's a very practical suggestion.
Okay, thank you.
Claudio DeGangi.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
So the IPC submitted comments on the provisions here, generally in support of them. One of the questions that came up during that process was if a UDRP was brought and the trademark owner won the UDRP, but they didn't generally qualify to register under .xxx, would they be able to get the transfer, or how would that work? Is that something that was...
Actually, I must say I've been the focus at this stage has been on the initial pre-launch rights protection mechanism rather as opposed to the post-launch processes. But that's a key point clearly for post-launch. And in fact, off the top of my head and without talking it through, if a trademark holder prevails under UDRP, that would suggest to me that that's equivalent to the rights under the initial RPM. And so the interesting thing is whether or not a post-launch blocking setup exists. And as I say, the focus of my activity to date has been pre-launch, but it's a good point.
What you're going to we've not had that issue because I don't believe we've ever had anyone in a legitimate sponsored TLD file a UDRP. There have been some filings in UDRPs where they were not enforcing their sponsorship charters, but in most of those, .cat, .museum, .co-op, we just haven't seen that issue. I'm going to let this gentleman go, and then Paul will go to you.
Hello, Sergey Gorbunov, RU Center. So it doesn't clear to me. Will trademark owners connected with the adult industry be able to block their names during Sunrise B? Or they can't. So no. only those who are not connected. Yes,
because the qualifying criteria will be either you're in the adult entertainment industry and subscribe to the community, or you're not, and you want to block it, and are not ever anticipating being part of the community. So it's not consistent to block and want to be part of the community.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further to the question about transfers post UDRP, we've actually encountered that problem in the .eu and other restricted TLDs where trade barriers have been lifted or have been put in place to keep U.S. citizens out of a CCTLD space. But one way that maybe you guys could handle it for the .XXX is how you define transfer, because if you define transfer in your agreement, in your registration agreement, as being either a transfer in as a live registration or a transfer of the right to block it and consistent with Sunrise B, then you can deal with the policy issue without us having to rewrite the UDRP, because all we have right now our cancellations and transfers. So we'll look to you guys to define transfer at the local registry level so that we don't run into the problem. That'd be great.
That's a very sound appendix to previous suggestion. Thank you.
Do we have any questions coming in on the chat mechanism? Not at this time. Okay. We have David Taylor from Lovells.
David Taylor from Hogan Lovells.
Oh, sorry.
If there's any American colleagues, I'll be lynched. just a question on the trademarks which you'll accept. Which jurisdictions are you going to accept them from?
That's a good question, and actually it's something we need to still specify. I mean, you can imagine the obvious areas, US, CTM, major trademark registries around the world. So the two key gating factors are date of registration and which particular jurisdictions. At the moment, we envisage it being pretty wide, but I just don't want to leave a hostage to fortune as to how wide it is.
Because obviously there's a lot of discussion about, you know, the country's substantive review, et cetera,
et cetera. I understand exactly.
And this is perfect, actually, for the XXX, because if you go back to the .eu and the launch there, I think it was 180 trademark applications for sex were filed in the Benelux just to be able to get sex.eu, so if you've got sex.XXX. And just one point on the gentleman from the free speech before. I just looked up. I wasn't just trying to look up Nina.com. Although I did come across Nina.com when I searched, but I couldn't find the Nina.com in the WIPO database or the NAF database, so I'm not sure whether we've got the right domain name or missing something.
Okay. I see one more question, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you. It's Jeffrey Douglas again. the first scenario I had was Breast.com being an adult entity, assuming Breast.com is a non-adult and non-trademarkable, they would not be able to block. That is, if I had a business that used the entity breast.com because breast is not a trademarkable title, I would not be able to block breast.xxx. Is that correct?
That's correct. Although, yeah, that's correct.
All right. With that, we are going to close out this particular time, and I want to thank Jonathan very much for being here today and for everyone giving their time. We really appreciate it. We also appreciate you thinking about our issues in innovative ways, and we appreciate very much. We look forward to further discussions as we flush out the process and policies with regards to this, and thank you again for being here today.
Thank you very much.
And so at this particular point, I would like to ask Christina and David to come up and join us at the dais, because I would like us to talk about some of the motions that are pending before the GNSO Council tomorrow so that we can look at providing guidance to them on how we should consider responding to some of the things that will be on the agenda for tomorrow. In addition, I think, Steve, you had mentioned earlier today in the CSG meeting that you wanted to discuss, and we will do that after this discussion, the vice chair issue with regards to vice chair of the council. That will be something we're going to discuss this afternoon. But I want to take this time while Christina's pulling some things up. Many of you may not know, but at the close of this meeting, some of our officers will be leaving us because they were term limited. So we will be losing three officers who have been with us for multiple years. One of our officers we already lost early on because Mark Bohannon left his previous position and has joined Red Hat Software. And so Steve Metallitz graciously stepped in and has been our interim treasurer. Then Sam, I think you're on the phone, aren't you, Sam? This is a check. We're checking to see whether you dialed out. Well, anyway, Sam has been with us for now four years, and he has been our secretary and run several elections for us, which is not an easy thing to do. And we are also losing Claudio DeGangi from INTA, who has been our vice president for 3 or 4 years. And I would like to extend my personal thanks to each of them for the time that they've dedicated to this organization over the last 3 or 4 years, and tell you all that the officers have agreed, and you all will be receiving this week in your email boxes a gift certificate from Amazon.com so that you can buy yourself hopefully some reading material that has nothing to do with the internet or intellectual property. I really think series about the girl who kicked the hornet's nest and, you know, the dragon tattoo. Those are really good books. I would check those out. But anyway, I just think that we all need to give them a round of applause for all that they've done for us. And I would also like to introduce our new officers. You ain't getting rid of me, so I'm sticking around. So those of you who wanted me gone, tough. And Steve Metallitz will be serving as our vice president. And Brian Winterfeld, Brian, are you here? There's stand up. Brian Winterfeld will be our new treasurer. And Stacy King, who's on the phone from Richemont International, is going to be our new secretary. And so I would like to extend our thanks to them for agreeing to serve. And I think we're going to have a really good year. Another thing you should all know is we've recently updated our bylaws. And our bylaws have been updated. And in the new bylaws, there are going to be committees, and we will be sending those committees out to the listserv, which we established this year. And I would like everyone on the phone and in this room that would like to participate in the committee to look over those committee and identify and let me know the committees you would be willing to serve on. We're trying to get greater involvement and spread the work a little bit so that we can be more efficient and effective in what we're doing. Also, if you have not seen, if you go to ipconstituency.org, you will see that we have a brand new website that has been totally revamped and is up, and with our online membership forms. And so I think we are moving along quickly and rapidly to trying to come into compliance with many of the things that were requested by the Board Governance Committee when they did the ICANN and GNSO reform. And so, well, we almost had it. In and out. I think there we go. Okay, so that's to come. So keep watching your mailboxes for that. And I do expect people to volunteer. Those of you, if I don't get volunteers, those of you that are designated representatives from our members may be assigned, because we really do need to get some involvement and help in getting things done. And a committee system is one way to take care of that. So. We're having some technical we are the worst technicians in the history of the world.
All right. The first one I know kind of from heart, so we'll just start with that one. And that is, as most of you are aware, the GNSO had initiated a policy development process on the issue of vertical integration. The working group that was chartered was unable to reach consensus and duly reported that to the board, who nonetheless decided that they were now the policymaking body and have adopted the policy recommendation that adopted the policy, rather, that's in the applicant guidebook. So the first motion is to terminate the actually to end the PDP. All right, it's not working.
How do you move that?
Medium, no. Medium is high. This is.
Come on.
Okay. Well, anyway, let's just forget that, and that way I can see it.
No.
Yeah.
There it is.
What? You got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Put on yours then.
This is
how, what do you do to my computer?
No, it's
okay.
Okay.
I mean, we'll try to get this off. Strange.
So in the meantime, just continue.
Whoa, okay. So in any event, the current motion, which has been made by Stefan Van Gelder, who has just been elected chair of the council, and seconded by Terry Davis, who is the non-com appointee that has been assigned to the contracted parties house, basically would terminate the PDP. There is a fairly strong sense that, and David, correct me if you disagree, but I think this motion is going to pass with probably objection from no one, pending whatever we decide to do. It doesn't seem to me, unless we want to just as a kind of protest issue in terms of how the board has dealt with the issue, unless that's what we want to do, I'm not sure that there is much value in voting against the motion, but I think it's certainly important that we at least talk about it.
Okay, I'll open up comments. I personally think, you know, they've completed their work. They'd submitted a report, correct, to the GNSO Council. It was that we have no consensus, correct?
But it also identified certain areas for which further. There was general agreement about, for example, the need to flesh out further the concept of single registrant TLDs. There also, for whatever reason, the working group refused to map the work product against the original charter. So there was a split within the working group as to whether or not the working group had, in fact, completed the work that it was chartered to do.
Okay. My personal thing is it's almost like a fait accompli. I mean, the board's already done it. If those are issues that need to be done, maybe there need to be new working groups that deal with specific sets of issues, the subsets of issues, rather than trying to do it globally.
It ends the PDP. So if there will be no working group unless there's a new PDP.
Well, David?
I was just going to say one of the options which we can also do is to abstain. And if we're doing protest, that might be the best way, because then you're asked for the reason why you're abstaining, so then we can put it on the record. So rather than vote against it, we might want to do that.
What do people think in the room? Should we abstain?
I thought under the new rules you weren't allowed to abstain in protest. It was only if you were conflicted.
Well, we'll just act like the board and we'll do it our way.
We won't use the word protest in the reason.
Okay. So that's solved. I do think we need to send a message here. What I'm most disturbed about, and I have heard about, and I'll say this publicly, my phone began buzzing off the desk after the board took their motion with regards to vertical integration, because basically we were told by Peter Dengate Thrush at our commercial constituency breakfast that we should quit writing the board. Now, that's not what I was told in Chicago at the INTA board meeting by the former CEO, who told us we were to write the board and get them involved. We were no longer to write the board, that we should concentrate our efforts at the GNSO because the board did nothing but implement policy that was given to it by the GNSO Council. So the first time they were given a policy or a direction, which is we have no direction, and you told us to either find a direction or tell us you couldn't, and here's what we're going to do based on their Nairobi recommendations with regard to VI, what'd they do? They just did what they wanted to. And everyone's saying, well, I don't understand why they dismantled the implementation recommendation team based on the fact that they had to do what the GNSO Council told them to do or the GNSO constituencies told them to do. But when they told them what to do with regard to VI, they just said, we're going to do what we think is best for the community. So I think they put themselves in a bit of an intellectually dishonest position. And there are a lot of trademark owners that are pretty upset about that. And it has cast even further doubt on the legitimacy of the process. So.
All right. Then the next motion has to do with the final report of the proposals for improvements to the RAA. Just a little bit of background of history. After the Register Fly debacle, Paul Toomey announced that it demonstrated that there was a need to revisit and amend the RAA, that public participation would be very important. And to make a very long story much shorter, the negotiations for what is now the 2009 RAA took place primarily, exclusively, between staff and the registrars. And notwithstanding the fact that you had numerous groups, including the IPC, submitting substantive suggested changes, including red line language to make it super easy, that was rejected. So when, in order to ensure that this issue didn't fall off the council's plate, in exchange for agreeing to pass the amendments, the agreement was that there would be future work on developing a registrant rights charter, which is what the ALAC and NCUC wanted, and in exploring a process in good faith for future possible amendments to the RAA, which is what we wanted. So there was a working group created to identify potential, there were two parts of the working group. Part A dealt with the registrant rights charter. Part B dealt with potential improvements to the RAA. The group finished its report in October, and my motion, which Mike Rodenbaugh seconded, would be to basically accept the final report, approve the registrant rights charter, and adopt a negotiation process that's set out in that report, namely that the prioritized list of topics that was developed would go to the council. They would have to filter them out and weed out which ones were properly the subject of consensus policy. And for the remaining ones, start negotiations, and the negotiation group would consist of staff, the registrars, and observers. In other words, affected, technically non-parties. And the sense that I got from the council discussions over the weekend is that the registrars really are not inclined to support the motion. The registries think it tries to do too much, and the NCSG is going to vote against it because there's no identification of the process by which observers will be identified and selected. So there's really three options. Option number one is that it's kind of a standard courtesy, I guess, for lack of a better word, on the council that any constituency or stakeholder group that wants to request that action on a motion be deferred until the next meeting can do that. So it's kind of you get one free pass, but it's only for the meeting for which the meeting is introduced. So there's that possibility. Option number two would be to actually vote on it in its current form, which I would be inclined to suggest against simply because I think it would not pass. And option number three, which is something that I have floated to the leadership of not only the non-commercial stakeholders group, but also to the both contracted party stakeholder groups, is that we divide the motion, go ahead with approving the registrant rights, and leave for the next meeting a motion that would essentially include the negotiation process portion, but also include some process that we would need to develop for identifying who would be, how the observers would be selected and who they would be. I'm inclined to either go with that or to just not object when the registrar stakeholder group says that they want to defer until next meeting.
David, what's your view?
I completely concur with Christina on that one. Certainly from what we've heard discussing with the registrars, it doesn't look as if it's going to fly. So it's the way it is.
Now, isn't the registrant's rights the non-commercial constituencies, or at least ALACs? It's ALAC. I think giving them something on this and getting this through and not letting it get bogged down in something else, I mean, I don't think we disagree with that. So I would counsel that probably the best is to bifurcate the motion, move forward with the registrants' rights where we do have consensus, and then hold off on the other, just because I believe that that's what frustrates people and builds animosity, is they feel like you're holding things back in this procedural quagmire. So I think the best thing to do is just push something that I think is good through, and the things that are more problematic to defer to a later date that can be discussed. Does anyone have comment or disagree? Moving on.
The next motion has to do with the Joint Applicant Support Working Group, and this is a working group that was chartered by the Council and ALAC to create kind of a framework for exploring should there be financial or other support for new GTLD applicants that would not have otherwise have the necessary resources, whether that's the money to put up the application fee or the letter of credit or the technological resources to actually run it. So the long and the short of it is that this motion would extend the charter of the working group to do the following: to establish criteria for financial need and a method of demonstrating that need, to define the mechanisms for determining whether an application for special consideration is to be granted, establishing a framework, including a possible recommendation for a separate ICANN-originated foundation, establish methods for continuing assistance, establish methods for coordinating any assistance that may be volunteered by relevant providers, whether it's consultants or translators or technology consultants, and establish policies and practices for fundraising and establishing links to possible donor agencies. It also talks about reviewing the basis for the $100,000 application base fee to determine its full origin, et cetera. I don't have a really good sense of where the council is on this motion. I think there's certainly the contracted parties are generally not amenable to the idea of ICANN providing financial support to anyone. I also personally am not enthralled with the idea that this working group would design a mechanism for establishing a foundation, and the foundation would be intended to deal with all of the auction proceeds that are expected to occur in the cases of string contention. So, you know, this is one I definitely would like some guidance on.
My personal thought is it's going to happen. So, I mean, do we really just want to try to push against the wind? This is going. They have all this money. They're going to have to do something. They're trying to encourage internet in third world countries and in areas where this is going to be an issue. And I don't want to be seen as being an obstructionist. These are, I mean, of all the areas that probably do need new GTLDs, those are it's the people who probably can't afford them that need them more than anyone. So that would be my guidance.
I don't disagree with that. I just am not sure of the wisdom of having a working group. First off, whether it's even within the purview of a council GNSO working group to develop a framework for a foundation for ICANN to administer. And second, in that event, and I haven't been able to get a clear answer on that from anyone in the legal department. And if that's surprise.
Sounds like my client.
And in that case, it doesn't seem to be a particularly useful exercise. So, you know, my view would be I could see supporting it if they would strip out the foundation-related language.
They could make a recommendation that ICANN establish a foundation, but then it would be ICANN and its attorneys that would take that. Steve?
Yeah, I had two questions about this. who is on this group, or who leads this group, or who's on this group? Now, and this would be the same group that exists now would be charged to do these things, right? And who is this Rafiq? And
this is Avri and Rafiq and Elaine Prius. Okay. I'm not sure who else is on it.
Okay, they've given themselves 11 things to do, and to do it in before the opening of the application round. And none of the that's one point, which leads me to believe that voting for this would be harmless. The other point is that nothing here actually takes effect until after it's approved by not just the GNSO Council, but if your criteria foundation, obviously it's going to go up to the board and everything else. So I'm not sure, again, in line with what Jay Scott said about, you know, supporting the need for new GTLDs and the IDN space and so forth. I'm just not sure that there's much downside to going along with this. I agree with you. I'm sure this motion could be improved and made a little bit more realistic. But if they feel that they can do this on this schedule, I'm not sure why the GNSO Council wouldn't let them try.
I was just to add to that, I think there's quite a bit of pushback on the GNSO Council on this because of the complex nature of it. So it's going to be an interesting discussion, I think, on Wednesday with this one. But I'd agree, I don't see what we actually lose by voting for it.
Could you make it to where it was affirmatively for round two and say, in essence, these folks need assistance. Round one is going to be extra complicated because it's all brand new. Round two will go much smoother. We will also know how much money is left over from the first round of auction, and just essentially say this is a great idea, but the delivery goals should not be for round one. They should be for round two.
It's a great idea. I think you could ask for a friendly amendment.
I think that's a very good idea. I'm just thinking through the political implications of it.
My concern is that, yeah, that would be viewed as let the big guys get all the good TLDs and then we'll help the little guys get the scraps in round two. I agree that it may be...
I think what you're talking about is putting in writing what is practical reality. And what I think Steve is saying is, I think you're right, but just to put it on paper makes us look obstructionist. So the best is just let them learn that in the process, because the reality is what you've just said is going to occur. The political capital for us to be reasonable and tell them is not worth it, because they're not going to listen to us. They're going to read bad intent into it. So it's let them learn by their own process, because they will learn that lesson.
No, definitely want to take it. I'm just saying, so what are we doing? Are we voting for it?
I think you should vote for it. I think I'm hearing that we should vote for it and that the process will take care of itself as the pig pushes through the pipeline.
All right, thanks. The next one is to approve the draft charter of the Joint DNS Security and Stability Analysis Working Group. And this is something that came out of the Brussels meeting. I don't know if you can click through to the charter, Steve. It's not at all controversial. And I think, again, this would be one where it doesn't seem to be worth any sacrifice to – It just doesn't seem to be worth it to vote against it.
Anyone have any strong feelings about this one? Okay, vote for it.
All right.
Next. Does anyone have a feeling, given that it's 2 degrees in here? If you'd want to warm up, you may step outside the lobby and you will gain 15 degrees in about 2 seconds.
And then there are these competing motions to extend the Policy Process Steering Committee and the Operations Steering Committee charters.
Also known as the Help Me Rhonda motions.
Can you cover this one? Because I'm just...
Okay, what is going on here? It's my understanding that a motion was put out by Wendy Seltzer from the NCUC, and it's my understanding that what they are trying to do is eliminate what they see as a barrier between the work that is going on within certain work teams and the GNSO Council, saying that they believe the Council is too removed from the work. So what you have now is you have the GNSO Council, and then you have an Operations Steering Committee and a Policy Development Steering Policy Process Steering Committee that sit here. And underneath that, they're populated with these work teams that are coming up with certain suggestions. They go up to these groups here, sort of at this level, and then they're matriculated through the system. And then these groups, after they're satisfied, pass them on up to the GNSO Council for approval. And what they're doing is they're trying to eliminate this and have the work teams report right into the GNSO Council under the illusion that the GNSO Council has so much time that they just really want to take on this work. I am chairman of the working group work team. We are the team that put together guidelines for use by work teams within the ICANN process. I can tell you that we've worked our tails off, and we do not want anything to derail what's going on. And my concern is by changing the system that everyone has finally gotten comfortable with mid-game will only lead to further delay. So I would strongly say that they should be extended.
Right. So we would vote for the initial motion and introduced by Chuck and seconded by Jeff Newman and vote against the Wendy Seltzer Mary.
And the only reason is because the system is working. And I'm afraid if we change it, then there's going to be this whole 3 or 4 month period, especially going into the holidays, for both China in January and the Christian world for Christmas. We're just coming out of Hanukkah. And I think, you know, there's a lot going on that delays just processes anyway. And then trying to figure out who's responsible for what, we'd be well past March before we figured out and the work would get clogged. So I think the best thing is we know the systems that they're working. Let's just continue on. We've not seen, in my opinion, no one can point to any abject failure. I think San Francisco, probably. And my work will be done then, so I don't care.
All right. Last but not least, the proposed motion on recommendations made recently by the Cross-Community Working Group regarding implementation of the Council's Recommendation 6. Recommendation 6 of the GNSO new GTLD policy recommendations dealt with essentially that strings should not be contrary to generally accepted international principles of law, something like that. The gist of it was that when we were working on the policy recommendations, we recognized that there needed to be some kind of mechanism or some kind of basis for if there was a string that was contrary to those generally accepted international principles of law to keep it from going forward. And to make a very long story short, both the GAC and the AILAC hated it. So as an outcome of the Brussels meeting, there was this cross-community working group created where you had a lot of people from AILAC, a lot of people from the GNSO, although I don't think we actually participated. I know I was on the mailing list, but I don't think anyone from the IPC participated.
I don't think we did.
And a couple individual GAC representatives participating in their individual country capacity, but there's no formal on behalf of the GAC participation because that's not how they work. So they came out with all of these new recommendations, and the purpose of this motion would be to basically endorse the recommendations so that to kind of set the stage for the board to act on them. The real concern that the folks behind this motion have is that if the GNSO does not endorse the recommendations, that there's no need for the board to act on them, and then you're back where we started. The recommendations, I have a few issues with some of them. Some of the changes I think that they're recommending don't make any sense. They're also, I think, kind of the key one and the one that it seems is really kind of stuck in the board's craw is that that the board should be ultimately responsible for all new GTLD applications decisions. And because this went to the issue of, if there's an expert panel, what role does that expert panel output have? Is the board automatically bound to accept it? Is it a factor that goes into consideration and the like? My issue with that recommendation is not so much relevant to this issue. I just really don't want to have a situation in which the board thinks that it can second-guess the outcomes of the legal rights objections, because I think it's pretty clear to all of us at this point that they just don't get trademarks, and I don't think that's going to change. So that's really my primary issue with this, in the sense that, well, aside from the fact that we didn't really participate as a constituency, we haven't put in comments on it, and I think some of the carryover implications of this would not be helpful. It's my sense that the contracted parties are unlikely to support it. So I don't, as of right now, it's as a result, I don't think we lose anything if we also vote against it.
I agree with you, Christina, and I think part of what's driving this motion is that the cross-community groups are you know, something somewhat, you know, new, and if I think the feeling is that if the GNSO is silent on it, it kind of, you know, works against this whole concept. What I was thinking is whether we would be able to maybe submit a friendly amendment or something. So instead of saying endorses the recommendations, it just says accepts or something along those lines that sort of takes away, you know, because the first resolve clause sort of refers to that, the fact that it's not consensus policy. So I was just thinking, you know, that would still sort of accomplish, I think, the goal behind this, which is to give some credence to the process, you know, that they all went through. But, you know, maybe if the language could be tweaked or something like that, so it's not a strong, you know, show of support for the actual recommendations.
Claudia, I can probably pick up on that one, because Mary herself, who's proposed this, has proposed a friendly amendment to it. So that's changing the resolved further and getting out the endorsed word, which seems to be causing a problem. And just so you know there, that this is currently on discussion, but resolved further, the council recommends that each stakeholder group provide feedback as soon as possible to the CWG in order to resolve outstanding questions regarding implementation of Recommendation 6 in a judicious manner, considering in particular those recommendations that received full consensus in the CWG. Chuck's indicated he thinks he's okay with it, and they're checking with their group, so we'll see.
So I think that if we need to hold off on a decision on this one until we see what the final language is over the next day or so, or the next 12 hours. And when we do, because you take breaks in those meetings, and we can circle up then. So I would say, based on it being acceptably worded, we would vote yes. If it stays as it's worded, or in the same sense of wording, different words, but the same sense of strong endorsement, we're not going to be able to vote for it. Is that the general sense of the room? Do I hear any objections to that summary? Good. Okay, now we're going to move on. We're done. We're going to go and discuss the vice chair.
Yeah, I think our council representative should stay up here,
yes,
for a minute, because this is really about a vote they have to make, although it's not a vote made at the council. Most of you were in the commercial stakeholders group meeting this morning. Please, I hope so, because I don't want to explain this again. But the issue of electing a vice chair for the GNSO Council is on the agenda right now. And we both have to decide, we meaning the non-contracted parties house, our stakeholder group and the non-commercial stakeholder group, have to decide both a method for selecting such a person, and we have to do that method and select such a person. Olga Cavalli is currently in that position, and her term expires at the end of the GNSO Council meeting, although I have to say that if, in fact, we don't fill this position until after her term expires, I doubt that the safety, security, and stability of the resiliency of the Internet would be significantly threatened. My recommendation, I'd be glad to go through the details, but we did a lot of that this morning. My recommendation is that we take the following position. We, the IPC, take the following position in the commercial stakeholders group and trying to negotiate this with our counterparts in the non-commercial stakeholder group. First, that there should be an election for this position. We have two candidates. One is Wolf Ulrich Noben, who is with the ISPs, and the other is Mary Wong, who is with the non-commercial stakeholder group. There should be an election between those two candidates. We don't think there's any other candidates. if there are, then this really gets complicated. But between those two candidates, there should be an election, and there should be 13 voters, six council reps from each stakeholder group, and the NOMCOM appointee to our house, Olga Cavalli. And that in order to win, you would need 8 out of 13 as a fallback. In order to win, you would need 7 out of 13, but at least one of those, you would have to have at least one vote from each stakeholder group, so that you couldn't elect somebody just based on all the non-commercials and Olga getting together and voting for somebody. And my expectation is that whether it would happen on the first round or would have to take a second round, is that Mary would probably be elected. And then the further recommendation, in order to spare us a certain amount of wasted time and energy at this time next year, is to provide that whichever stakeholder group's candidate loses the election will have the option, which they don't have to exercise, but they would have the option of putting forward a candidate for vice chair a year from now, and everyone would agree that unless there's some extraordinary circumstance, that candidate would be elected a year from now. So in other words, we would be rotating, and assuming, if I'm right, that Mary wins and the non-commercial stakeholder group has the seat this year, fills that slot this year, then our stakeholder group would get to fill it next year if we wanted to. There might be circumstances in which we don't want to, but I don't want to get into that. So that's my recommendation for how to kind of resolve what's become a very knotty problem with a lot of, intrigue and back, corridor chatter going on. I think it's just the simplest way to do it. It's not perfect, but that would be my recommendation. So I would ask for discussion about that or any questions about that, because I know it's rather convoluted. And ultimately, I hope the IPC could endorse that position.
I want a show of hands for how many people care. No, I'm sorry. Ouch. Ooh. So do we hear anyone that objects to that particular plan? Is there anyone on the phone that's just dying to object to this plan? No? That's our plan.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm bringing the meeting to a close. Everyone, have it. That's it. That's it. Any other businesses, drinks later on tonight, I guess, but that's all.